This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Crossover podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What's happening, my friend? How are you?
I'm good. A little sick last week. Back into the mix, though. I meant to tell you on last week's pod, I went to my first game of the season about 2.5 weeks ago. And I know you've been to a couple of games already this year. I went, and I don't think I'll be going back. I don't see any upside. I was at the TD Garden for a Celtics game during a recent homestand, and you sit there and you get to watch the game from your usual press seat, but without any interactions with, you know, coaches and staffers, and then potential interactions with players one-on-one, there's no upside to going to these games. Like, it's disappointing because, you know, people don't care how the sausage is made, but, you know, you get a lot of good stuff just being around people and being around these teams up close and personal. It's much harder to do that at this point. So had my first experience, Howard. It wasn't through no fault of the team or the game or anything like that. It just wasn't a great experience.
No, I mean, listen, we are where we are, and this is what the league has to do. We all understand it. And this is not to complain. I want listeners to think that either of us is complaining about this because it's what's necessary, and it's this is the reality of our world amid a pandemic right now. But I will just say, if you're a sports fan, if you're an NBA fan, and I hope you are if you're listening to this, it's what you don't realize what you are actually missing right now, because people like us, Chris, me, all of our friends in the NBA media, sports media, the job is not just about the games, right? It's about the people and the personalities, and yes, the rumors and the drama and the conflict and everything. You cannot possibly appreciate or learn or get into all of the weeds on all that stuff when you're doing all your interviews on Zoom with 50 other people on the line. Like, so much of what we get, so much of what we learn about the people that we cover personally, professionally, is because we are interacting face to face. It's just like anybody else. Like, folks, if you're home and you're not going to your office, think about how much less of a sense you have of your coworkers day to day now than you did a year ago before all this started. You know, it's just those personal interactions and the little things that you pick up. Just FaceTime with people is so much more valuable, obviously, than that. So yeah, like, I've been to one game, Chris. It was Warriors Nets on opening night at Barclays, and I wanted to be there because I wanted to see the spectacle of Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving finally making their debut together, and KD his debut period with the Nets in an empty building. And it was just as disconcerting and bizarre as I expected it to be. But that's it. There's no other reason to be there. There's not enough that you can pick up just by being at a game watching instead of watching on TV. And in fact, you get a lot better view for the most part on TV than in person. And without being able to interact with guys face to face, there's really no point for people like us to go. So just waiting for that moment when the world gets vaccinated and we can return to normalcy.
Yeah, hopefully next season we can be back in some kind of normal capacity, because that was just, it's almost depressing, you know, kind of sitting there being like, all right, I'm, you know, pained in by plexiglass. I am kind of waving at some of the staffers I know from the two teams that were out there. It's just, you know, and look, if you've been around a little bit, there's ways to kind of reach out to people. We all have, you know, Rolodexes of, you know, different coaches and players and agents and whatnot. But yeah, there's some things some bits of information come upon you when you're not looking for it. You know, yeah, when a guy might mention something just sitting there courtside that he picked up on from a couple of games ago.
And the thing is, like, what the reader, what the fans can't see is what's missing, right? So there are insights and tidbits and observations that would be in stories that we're reporting week to week, day to day, that just aren't there. It's hard to miss the absence of it. You don't know what you're missing. You don't know what you've lost. You just know. But I guarantee you, the coverage this season is different. It's just fundamentally different, and not different in a good way. Like, you can only lose detail and nuance doing it this way. Although, by the way, you mentioned the Rolodex, which we always all refer to. Does anybody actually have a physical Rolodex anymore? When's the last time you saw a Rolodex?
I don't have a physical Rolodex. I still use the paper planner, or like the binder planner, right? Like the
really?
Black book. I still use that. I still like to flip it open in the morning to kind of see what I've scrawled out. I back it up, you know, with the phone and, you know, beeping in, hey, podcast with Howard Beck on Tuesday. But I'd like to have the planner around just in case. But yeah, it's not but easy to do certain things, and it certainly hasn't made it much fun or given you much reason to go over to arenas. So I don't think I'll be going back, you know, whether it's, you know, playoffs or otherwise. There's just no real upside to actually doing it.
I'll tell you one thing I'm not going to. I'm not going to that ridiculous All-Star game they're trying to put together in Atlanta.
Should we talk about that? Like, maybe
we might as well.
Like, yeah, the All-Star game, as we're recording this, the details have kind of spilled out today. But it's going to be in Atlanta. It's going to basically be a one-day event down there. I have no idea why they're doing this. Like, this just seems like
money.
An unnecessary... Well, yeah, but you're right, money. But it just seems like an unnecessary risk to bring... Put everybody on planes and bring them down to a city, and then presumably a city, by the way, which has fans in the stands, as we learned from courtside Karen this week, you know, yelling at LeBron during the game. Your mom must be proud. But I mean, the idea that this is necessary. Look, I like the idea of having All-Stars, like have a regular All-Star ballot, give guys the honor of being called NBA All-Stars. But is it? I mean, are they really making that much money that off an All-Star game that it's necessary to go through with it? I mean, I guess they are, because there's no other reason to do it. There's no other reason to take the risk of bringing, you know, dozens of players, coaches, staffers, whatnot, you know, team employees that follow these players down to Atlanta for this game. It just seems like the NBA, I've got plenty of issues. I've had and I've written about my issues with the NBA and what they've done kind of with these first couple of months of the season. This is another beef I have with them, that they're doing an All-Star game when they could satisfy, you know, certain obligations by just announcing all stars. And I think it's, I don't know about you, but I think it's a completely unnecessary risk.
Nah, listen, guys should get the honor, and the ballots are out. We will elect all stars. And that's as it should be for posterity. Right. And so for, you know, contract clauses and all kinds of other stuff too, you know, bonuses and all that. That's fine. But the All-Star game itself, look, some years it's a lot of fun. A lot of years, it's pretty crappy. It's a spectacle. It's not essential.
Wait. When is it fun? Like, I don't...
The Elam ending last year, that was fun.
All right, yeah. I mean, the ending of the game, like, the event itself, like, who cares? Like, it's just...
Yeah.
I don't know. The whole thing... I stopped going years ago.
I still go for all the schmoozing and all the just being around the NBA, but that's fine. But, like...
But even that, Howard, even that, there are better options for that. Like, I agree, that's a necessary component, but you can go, you know, Summer League supplies that. Even the Portsmouth Invitational kind of supplies that. Like, the Combine usually supplies that. Like,
no, there are other places. You're right. Look, All-Star Weekend, I think, you know, look, there's the corporate sponsors, all the corporate people they bring in who are comprising most of the audience for those things. So
you
it's
go
that
for the
part.
Free swag bag is what you go for.
I've gotten a lot of really good swag. I still have my NBA umbrella one of the New Orleans All-Star games when it like drenched us during the tech summit, and they handed out these free umbrellas to everybody as they were leaving. I've still got that umbrella. It's a little tattered now. It's getting beaten
Continue.
Up.
Sorry.
But the game, the dunk contest, 3-point shootout, I think if you're a kid or if you're younger, like that still holds a lot of allure. I think for guys like you and me who've seen way too many of these, it's just not as entertaining anymore, but I'm not going to tell other people that they shouldn't find it entertaining. So it's fine. Like it serves its purpose, but let's put it this way. Is it essential during a pandemic? You could say, is the NBA essential? Well, no, but the NBA also is the provider of thousands and thousands of jobs, and it's a revenue generator. And so I understand restarting the season. I don't think anybody said don't have an NBA season. But you're doing it within certain limits that you've already imposed. 72 games instead of 82. No fans. They're sacrificing God knows how many hundreds of millions in not having fans. There are certain conditions that you believe you have to impose to make this workable and safe, or at least semi-safe. And yet still we've had 24 games or whatever postponed so far. and a lot of guys who have gotten sick. So you're just ranking levels of essentialness, right? You've decided the games are important enough because of the money, because of the jobs, because of all that. The All-Star game and All-Star weekend is completely non-essential. That is where you should draw the line. It's an exhibition game and not a very good one most years. So why are you, as you put it, Chris, why are you putting all these guys on planes from all these various parts of the country, flying them into Georgia, which has done a really crappy job with this pandemic and has been really, hands-off. People, from what I gather, not a lot of mask wearing going on in Atlanta. And you're going to put an All-Star game together there? Why? You don't need to do this. Whatever money is being lost, find it somewhere else. You can weather that storm. You're already losing hundreds of millions this season anyway. Just deal with it. I'm sure some part of this is that, Turner, which broadcasts all of All-Star Weekend, really wants it. I'm sure the players who have to sign off on this, there's certainly some financial incentive for them. I don't get it. This is where you should draw the line.
They're slaves to the TV network right now, and it's their only source of real income, so I get it, but to me, it's just an unnecessary risk. Just do away with it. Come back next year. Swallow a little bit more of a loss.
No one will miss it.
No one will miss it. All right, let's talk about the Utah Jazz for a second. We're opening with the Utah Jazz, Howard. How about that? First topic is Utah. My Utah Jazz, I should add, as I was the lone
Utah
member.
Utah Jazz, wow.
My Utah Jazz, the lone member of our staff, vigorously defending them on our SI video hits this week. You can check those out over at SI.com. I'm a believer in the Jazz. They had an 11-game winning streak snapped against Denver. They're still in a dogfight for the top seed in the Western Conference. I think this team is for real. I mean, this was a team that was a Mike Conley jumper from maybe being what Denver turned out to be in the bubble. Denver was this Cinderella team, gets to the conference finals, looks like a team of the future. A Mike Conley jumper going off in Game 7 was the only thing preventing Utah from getting to that second round and maybe becoming what the Nuggets ultimately became. And I think the Jazz have become better this year, are better this year than what they were last year. You have got Bojan Bogdanovic back in the mix, a guy that missed the bubble because of injury last season. This is a legitimate 15 to 20 point per game scorer every single night. This guy is a legit scorer in this league. You've got Mike Conley, who perhaps understandably was a little bit lost last season, trying to work his way into a new team, figure out how to play in Quinn Snyder's system. He has been a completely different player. As we tape this, Howard, Mike Conley's plus minus is like ridiculous. His plus minus, I think, is like 40 plus points better than the guy in second place, Kawhi Leonard. Like, Mike Conley's having, like, speaking of all-stars, all-star season for Mike Conley. You've got Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert. Their relationship seems like it's repaired, at least as far as it's going to be. Both these guys now under long-term contracts with the Jazz. And you have Jordan Clarkson, who has become the sixth man of the year, at least the front runner for it right now. I'm all in on the Jazz as being a legitimate threat to beat the Lakers, Clippers, anybody else in the Western Conference. I think their depth scares me a little bit, or lack thereof. Jordan Clarkson in the playoffs scares me a little bit, but Donovan Mitchell, Mike Conley, Joe Ingles, Rudy Gobert, that revamped front line, like, I am all in on the Jazz as a title contender. What say you?
All right, so if the question is, like, are they legitimate? Yeah, they're legitimate. Are they legitimately good? Legitimately great? Yeah, like, no problem there. When we say legitimate contender, it gets a little bit more difficult because it's about who you have to go through now. You know, you point out that they were Mike Conley jumper away from beating the Nuggets in the first round. Absolutely. Yes, they were that close to beating the Denver Nuggets. Would they have matched up as well with the Clippers? Would all of the Clipper drama have been avoided if they had only been able to face the Jazz instead of the Nuggets? We have a much different history in LA too. Maybe Doc is still coaching there for all we know. I don't know that they were going to beat the Clippers. The Nuggets had a certain advantage there with, Jokic just being able to just, drub them, but I don't know. So let me make the case for why the Jazz are legit before I throw a little bit of cold water. All right, so they're fifth in offense and sixth in defense. So if you're top 10 in both offensive and defensive efficiency, you're legit. And we're only a quarter way of the season. Yeah, there's still some noise in the stats, but still, the signs are all good. Their net rating is 7.2 points per 100 possessions. The only teams they're behind in net rating, Milwaukee and the two LA teams. So that by definition says you are a contender, right? You are among the top four teams in the league in net rating. They are first in three-pointers made, 17 per game. They're first in three-point attempts. They're third in three-point percentage. All great signs for contending in today's NBA, right? And those are up significantly from last year. Last year, they were 10th in attempts, sixth in three-pointers made. They're making, like, I think almost four more three-pointers a game than last year. It's their first full season with Clarkson, who's been fantastic there. Shout out to Jordan Clarkson, by the way, for, I think, completely changing the perceptions of him by embracing a role, becoming more efficient. Sometimes you just got to be in the right spot. Like, he was miscast, of course, as like some next generation of Lakers star when he was in LA, and then he's in Cleveland in an awkward time as LeBron's on his way out the door. Like, this is the perfect role for him, and he's been great.
He was trending to like Ricky Davis territory before he came to Utah. Like, just, you know, gunner, yeah. Get you some shots, yeah. Good player on a bad team, but he's turned it around. You're right.
He's been great. He's been great. And props to the Jazz, I think, for getting the best out of him too. And to Quinn Snyder for putting, you know, the right framework around and setting the right bar for him to reach for. And Conley's healthier and more comfortable there in this role. You mentioned Bogdanovich. Our friend David Locke, Jazz broadcasters, put up this stat earlier today. They're 7-4 right now against over 500 teams. They were 13-18 against over 500 teams last year. Again, it's early, but those are good signs. They've beaten the Clippers. They've beaten the Bucks. They've beaten the Nuggets. They've also lost to the Nuggets. They have yet to play the Lakers or the Sixers. They have yet to play the Celtics. And they got crushed by the Nets on January 5th, 130-96. So, like, I think the signs are all there, Chris. Like, they can hang with the big boys. They're there. They're in the conversation. Where I draw the line is to say that I'm not sure that they could actually knock off the Lakers and Clippers, because that comes down to matchups now. If you're playing the Lakers, at some point LeBron is just going to go try to shut down Donovan Mitchell for a key stretch of the fourth quarter. And I don't know that Donovan Mitchell is going to be able to get a shot off. Who do the Jazz have to deal with LeBron or Anthony Davis? Is Gobert going to be on Anthony Davis? If they're, you know, and what happens to the Jazz offense if you throttle Donovan Mitchell? Does Mike Conley have enough left as a playmaker to keep the offense going if the defense is all shaded towards stopping Donovan Mitchell? Like, that, I don't know that there's enough dynamism in the offense. They got a lot of guys who can make open shots, and they got a couple guys who can create, but create at an elite level is really only Donovan Mitchell. And then against the Clippers, like, now you got two guys in Paul George and Kawhi Leonard who could both blanket Donovan Mitchell. And again, who's guarding those guys? Joe Ingles? Royce O'Neal? Like, I think the matchups are difficult. And I believe in the Jazz as a great regular season team that might even be a great playoff team. Where I draw the line is that I'm not sure they can beat either of the LA teams. I'm not sure they're going to be able to. Like, whenever they finally match up with one of them, whichever round that is, I still think that's where their postseason ends.
Yeah, well, points well taken. And offensively, I think there could be a crash coming for the Jazz. They're top five in offense right now, and they're doing it in part based on great three-point shooting. I'm not sure that's going to hold up over the course of the season. But my faith in them is that their defense is good. I think they're sixth right now in defensive rating. And it's only going to get better, I think. I think they have the ability to be top three, maybe the number one defense in basketball. I mean, they've got they've got some good defensive players on that team. Gobert is a menace. Like, you know, every year is a worthy vote for defensive player of the year. And this year is no exception. I mean, they have the ability to grind the game down to a halt and win street fights, win ugly. Now, you're right. You have to see what they do against the Lakers and the Clippers and the Celtics and some of these top-tier teams that they're going to go up against. I remember watching that Nets game. That was ugly. But I don't mean, I don't know. I like the mix of talent that they have. I think Mike Conley can be that guy that takes pressure off of Donovan Mitchell, whether it's shot making or playmaking. I love watching Joe Ingles out there because the ball really moves when Joe Ingles is out on the floor. So I think they've got more than a puncher's chance in a series against the Lakers or the Clippers. I really do. I'm really believing in that mix.
Yeah, you're right. They still have upside. Like the defense, we've seen this team be a top defensive team in the NBA. And, you know, look, the difference between being top six versus number one, you know, there's a difference, but that's not a big leap to ask of them. They can get there. I don't know how much more they can get out of the offense. I think the three-point shooting can actually sustain, to be honest. Like they, so last year they led in three-point percentage at 380. And they're at 399. They're almost shooting 40% as a team from three, which is insane.
So that's what I'm talking about, though. That may inch down.
It may come down a little bit, but they've got a track record of being the top 3-point percentage team in the league. So, like, okay, they'll be fine there one way or another. But when things slow down in the playoffs, when it's more half court, when defenses key in on your best player and try to take away the things that you do best, that's when I worry about them. The reason that teams load up and try to create super teams is because even if you can somehow, you know, make LeBron a little less efficient, you still got to now deal with Dwayne Wade. You know, you shade everything toward Paul George, Kawhi Leonard's going to beat you. You shade everything, you know, like that's how it goes. You want two stars, even three, because teams get really smart and clever in the playoffs. They scheme for you in a way that they don't in the regular season, and they do everything possible to take away your best guy. Like that was the problem, obviously, with the Rockets being so Harden centric, right? You're gonna in the regular season, it's fine. No one's trying to create a defense to stop the Rockets in the regular season, but in a best of seven series, that's all you got to concentrate on, all you got to scout, and all you got to plan for. That's what you're doing, and I've always said this, and I'll keep saying it. I always want to see teams that can do it a different way, that don't have to create a super team, because there's not enough talent for everybody to create a super team. So we need an antidote to super teams. And so I would love to see a team like the Jazz break through. But I think there's a certain reality there when you're going against Paul George and Kawhi Leonard or LeBron and AD, you know, that may be too much to ask of this team, even if they do everything perfectly.
Can I just say this about the Shaq comment from a couple of weeks back? I know you and Michael Lee talked about this last week, but I was perplexed by that comment. If for no other reason than, look, Shaq was a great player individually, you know, no argument there. He didn't win anything until he had another superstar around him, did he? He didn't win Jack until he had Kobe around him. Didn't win another championship until he had Dwayne Wade around him. He didn't even get to the finals until he had Penny Hardaway around him. Not to say Shaq wasn't the alpha of all those teams, but I'm a little tired of, you know, these star players, you know, pointing out that or saying that someone like Donovan Mitchell doesn't have what it takes. Give Donovan Mitchell the tools that these other stars have had, and I think he does have what it takes. It's certainly an open question. He has to do it. And this would be the year, Howard. Like, last year, even though he lost in the first round, really wasn't underachieving. I didn't see that as being the Jazz underachieving. They got beat in the last second by a better team. They were without one of their leading scorers. Mike Conley still working his way back. Plus, they had all the drama of everything that went on right before the season stopped. This would be the year where if they flame out in the first round, then you point your finger at Donovan Mitchell. And then you say, you are showing signs that you can't get it done. But if the Jazz get to the conference finals, I'm not even saying the NBA finals. I'm still not sure that they're, you know, they're not the kind of lock the Lakers were back in the day of being great, or the lock that the Heat were with Shaq and D Wade back in, what was it, 06. But if they get to the conference finals, that's yet another sign that Mitchell is capable of all this. I mean, I grow weary, Howard, of like the, you know, you don't have what it, that whole comment like drove me nuts, because saying guy doesn't have what it takes when he doesn't have the talent that you had around you, that doesn't ring true to me. That just doesn't ring well.
Well, I think it's more like, well, what does that mean? He doesn't have what it takes. Does it mean you don't think he has the leadership abilities? Do you think it's because he doesn't have the desire, the work ethic? Is he not enough of a playmaker?
He's got all those things. Like he's got like, the desire. He's right. got the work ethic. He's got it all.
Yes. No. But by all accounts, Donovan Mitchell is a great guy, high character guy, hardworking guy, solid leader. I mean, he's only 24. He's still learning to be a leader. He just made his first All-Star team a year ago. This isn't like he's been in the league for 10 years and you're like, yep, he doesn't have what it takes. He's never going to get it. He's been in the league for four. This is his fourth season. Like, he's still evolving as a player. He's improved every year. You know, if you want to say, well, there aren't that many like 6 feet guards, 6 foot tall guards who have led their teams to a champ. Okay. If you want to go historic and the kind of star that you need, I mean, there was obviously for decades, the NBA was ruled by big men, right? It was Shaq and Kareem and Wilt and Hakeem. And you could like Jordan changed that, of course. But in the modern game, it's what I call like the mutant forwards, right? Like these guys like who are built like power forwards or somewhere between small forward and power forward, but have ball handling skills and could do everything. Kawhi Leonard and Kevin Durant and LeBron James. Yeah, if you have one of those guys, Donovan Mitchell cannot grow 8 inches and get a 7 foot wingspan tomorrow. He cannot become Kevin Durant or LeBron or Kawhi. He can't even become Steph Curry. But that's not the way to judge Donovan Mitchell as a guy who can potentially lead a team to a title or not. If Shaq's critique were of what Donovan Mitchell was doing, the way he conducted himself, the way he worked, the way he competed, fine. But it's more this like ambiguous kind of doesn't have what it takes. Like, and you're right, Chris, too. They have a second star, but their second star is Rudy Gobert. He's essentially a defensive specialist. Apologies to Utah. I know nobody wants to hear that Rudy Gobert is not an offensive player because sometimes he puts up 17 or 20 points in a game. He's not a go-to offensive player. And most 1-2 punches in NBA history, when we talk about championship teams, are two elite offensive players. Rudy Gobert is a fine offensive something. He's an option. He is among your options. He is not a go-to guy. It's not the same. And they don't have that second guy, Chris. And I don't know if they'll get that second guy because it is Utah and it's not a free agent destination. But that's why I say, can you do it a different way? Can you build a contender a different way? And credit to them, they have built a really phenomenal team that, as you said earlier, has a puncher's chance.
All right, so the Jazz are good. The Dallas Mavericks are bad, like really bad. As we record this, they've lost 6 straight games back-to-back to Phoenix at home, by the way. Giving up a lot of points, missing threes left and right. The language coming out of the locker room's not very good. Rick Carlisle doesn't seem to have an answer for it, and Rick's one of the better coaches in this league. What's going on in Dallas? I mean, you look at the stat sheets. Luka Doncic is putting up MVP-level numbers, but there are games. They're just getting clobbered. You know, they go to Utah. They lose 2 games, both by double digits. They give up 133 points to Houston a couple of weeks back. What's going on in Dallas right now?
I'm not sure. I mean, this is what a team that's set the bar that high falls this quickly. And let's be careful about this. We're still only about the quarter way mark. Like they can work this out. They've had guys dealing with, you know, COVID and quarantine. They've had some injuries. And they're kind of a, you know, we focus so much on Luka Doncic because he's this transcendent player, this once in a generation kind of player who, you know, was already maybe prematurely entering the MVP discussion, but he's an MVP caliber player. They're actually more of the better than the sum of their parts kind of team when it comes down to it. The record that they put up last year, the games they won last year, the reason that we all started really paying attention, aside from Luka's gaudy stats, was that team achieved way beyond what we expected. Porzingis playing at a pseudo all-star level when he was healthy, sure. But Dwight Powell, Dorian Finney-Smith, and, you know, Tim Hardaway Jr., who was just, you know, a salary dump by the Knicks when they traded Porzingis. This is not a team that was stocked with high-level talent. Like, even like Seth Curry's a really good player. He's become a really good player who they, I think, maybe foolishly offloaded in the offseason, that trade for Richardson. But they were a better than the sum of their parts kind of team, Chris. They didn't have like across the board high level talent. But Rick Carlisle is a magician, and he always gets the best out of players. He always gets guys to play their roles to the hilt, and that's what they did. So you had the combination of Luka being transcendent, Porzingis being really, really good, and a bunch of guys who anywhere else you would have thought they were just kind of like throwaway pieces, Maxi Kleber's and all these guys. But they were great last year, and they played their roles to the hilt. And sometimes I think there's a lightning in a bottle element where you can't always replicate that. So Porzingis has backslid a little bit, and Luka alleged, you know, reportedly came in not quite in prime shape, and they swapped out Curry for Richardson, and suddenly the chemistry is just not quite the same, and everything's not quite as finely tuned as it was, and their historically great offense has suddenly tumbled all the way to 21st in the NBA. Like, you can get away with your porous defense, which they already weren't great defensively, but their offense, Chris, is down by 7 points per 100 possessions from last season. And if your defense is average to below average, you can't afford that kind of drop-off in your scoring.
Yeah, a couple things that jump off when I watch Dallas games. One, they don't play hard all the time. Like, that's inexcusable. Like, you know, effort can be controlled. And when I watch some of these games, excuse me, I don't see the level of effort I saw from that team last year. That's number one. Number two, Porzingis has been bad. I mean, defensively, he was never very good. Now, offensively, Howard, the guy's shooting 10 threes per game. He's making 30% of them. Like, stop shooting threes. Stop shooting. I know we all kind of have him as this unicorn, like this three-point shooting, you know, big man who's over 7 feet tall. At some point, you got to make these threes to be called a unicorn and be called a three-point shooting big man. He's not making them right now. That's a problem for this team. Now, to your earlier point, you can give them a bit of a pass for a couple of reasons. They've had a lot of road games. 11 of the first 16 games were on the road. They've had myriad COVID issues, like several other teams in the league, but they've had a bunch of them. So a bunch of guys out with that. So as they go into this next stretch, where I think they play 9 of their next 11 at home, this is going to be the make or break stretch for them. If they turn it around, and look, they didn't look like they were turning it around against Phoenix those first two home games, but if they can turn it, if they're going to turn it around, it's February that's going to happen. They're going to have to show some life in this month in order to get back into the playoff mix. I think Doncic is doing everything he can do at this point, but you need the role players to make shots. You need Porzingis to make shots, and you need guys to show some effort defensively. They are showing no life on that end of the floor, and that's correctable. Like, that is something that you should be able to go into practice or go into the gym and fix. And if we don't see that over the next 11 games, I'm not sure, you know, how far the Mavericks can sink.
Yeah, I will say this, like, watching last night's game, Porzingis actually had some big plays down the stretch. Hit a couple, I think both of his, he was 3 for 7 from three, and I think two of those were like in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, that pushed him
minutes.
Above 30%. Got him back above 30% from three.
But he hit a late three, or maybe two late threes, had a big block late. He had three blocks in that game. Finished with 19 and 10. Like, it was a decent Porzingis performance, and like, that's what they need from him every night. And if they get that, everybody else will probably look a little better too. And I don't want to be alarmist when we're only a quarter way into the season, given how weird this season is. But look, the bottom line is they're already in trouble when it comes to the playoffs, as you were just alluding to. The West is still brutal. You've got 5 to 6 teams that I think are almost locks, right? Lakers and Clippers are locks. Jazz are a lock. Nuggets are a lock. That's 4. I think Portland's a lock. That's 5. Phoenix, probable. That's 6. So now you've got Memphis, the Warriors, the Rockets, Spurs, and the Mavericks. And who knows? Maybe the Pelicans turn it around. Like, there's a lot of teams that are jockeying for those last couple of spots. And, you know, I think we all wanted to say, well, once the Rockets unloaded Harden, that's it, they're done. But they're pretty competitive. And, you know, Wall, Oladipo, Christian Wood, like, this is like a fun team with a bunch of guys who all feel like they've got something to prove. You know, we write off the Spurs every year at our own peril. The Warriors, I'm still not sure, but they've gotten enough from Wiseman and enough promising signs from Andrew Wiggins, big fat asterisk on that statement. That you could, you know, you can't dismiss the Warriors. So I don't know how much room for error the Mavericks have right now. And yeah, I think it's a very real possibility they're going to miss the playoffs.
Can't count out the Warriors. I think with Steph and, you know, those guys there, I think they'll find their way into the playoffs. So that puts the Mavericks in a not a great position if they don't get this thing together over the next 10, 11 games. All right, let me finish with the Bradley Beal stuff. Earlier this week, The Athletic reported that Bradley Beal did not want to be traded, which flies in the face of some of the video that surfaced on Twitter over the last couple of days, specifically the first half of the Wizards game against Brooklyn, where Beal looked like he wanted to be anywhere but there. If I was watching just that first half, Howard, it looked like Bradley Beal was taking a page out of the James Harden playbook, where Harden kind of, you know, sleepwalked his way through the last few games in Houston and forced a deal. Now, watch the whole game, as you have to, and the Wizards had an incredible comeback, spearheaded in part by Beal and Russell Westbrook, and wound up beating the Nets in that game. But you left that game, and if you're watching the situation, you can't help but think that Bradley Beal only has a finite number of amount of time left in Washington. Now this report comes out, and I have no reason to dispute the report, but I don't know, Howard. Like, I can't see Bradley Beal being in Washington much past, if not the trade deadline, then next summer at the latest. I mean, it just seems like they're reaching a breaking point with Beal. And while they did win that game against Brooklyn, and two of their wins have come against Brooklyn, which is amazing, they did win that game, but I can't see this team making some kind of great turnaround over the last three quarters of the season. So, you know, it's interesting to read that Beal doesn't want to be traded. I'm not so sure believing that's not just Beal being a good soldier.
Well, and that's consistent with his character and his stance, right? Like, he's been the good soldier for years there. Every time this has come up, and it, you know, it comes and goes, and it's louder now for obvious reasons. But at this, you know, the discussion about whether Bradley Beal could be traded, should be traded, like, that's been going on for a few years now. And to his credit, he's like, nah, this is where I want to be. I want to stick it out. I want to win here, and I'm going to be patient. And like, I can only praise him for that. I don't think he has to be loyal to them. There is no loyalty in professional sports. We know this. But if you decide as a superstar, this is where I want to be, I'm going to ride it out. I believe in management. I believe in the direction we're going. I think we can do it, and I'd rather do it here. I've got nothing but respect for that personally, Chris. If Bradley Beal, and so this is the story in The Athletic, is like he says this. He's privately frustrated and confused with the perpetual portrayal of his situation, according to sources familiar with his thinking. After seeing other players take criticism for requesting to leave teams, those sources say Beal feels he's getting nitpicked for choosing to stay in DC. I haven't seen that, Chris. Like, I kind of feel like we're in this time now where with social media and all the other media and 24/7 debate shows, you can always find somebody who's going to like nitpick you or criticize you for something. I've not heard some overwhelming criticism out there of Bradley Beal where people are saying he's a bad person for not wanting out. Like, where is that take? I have yet to see that. I'm sure it's out there somewhere because there is a take for everything. Somebody has said something, like everything under the sun, every take has been said, tweeted, uttered somewhere, I'm sure. But I haven't heard that. If Bradley Beal asked out tomorrow, I'd say he's absolutely justified for wanting out. And if you were to ask me in general whether I think he will eventually reach that point, I'd say given where the NBA is, given the last 10 years, given player empowerment, given Bradley Beal's age, 27, thick of his prime, given where the Wizards are, I'd say, as I've said many times, like absolutely positively, I think he should want out. I think he'd be better off somewhere else. I think the Wizards would probably be better off because if they can get the right deal back for him, they can rebuild for the future. And I think they're kind of stuck. But I'm not criticizing him for not doing that. Like, if he wants to stay, that's his prerogative. Like, that's fine. I don't understand this. Like, that's the one thing about the report I don't get. Like, he feels he's being nitpicked for choosing to stay. Like, who's doing that?
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen any of that stuff. And look, Bradley Beal can look at James Harden as being a blueprint for getting what you want. I mean, James Harden sulked his way through an abbreviated training camp, sleepwalked his way through games, and within a matter of weeks, wound up traded to the location he wanted to be traded to, and will wind up not only getting to play where he wants to play, but eventually will get his money. You know, the money he turned down on that long-term extension. If you're Bradley Beal, and let's say hypothetically, you think Golden State is a good opportunity, you could stomp your feet and probably force your way there. Like, you could leak it out through an agent or somebody that you want to play for the Warriors, and you could force the Wizards front office to negotiate with there. And look, you and I have discussed that potential deal in the past. Like, that's a deal I think makes a lot of sense, because the Warriors have, they've got Wiseman, they've got some draft capital, they can do some things and put a package together that might make sense for them to go out and acquire Bradley Beal. I am with you, though. I will not criticize the guy for doing the right thing. I thought, look, it did look like he was checked out in the first half of that Nets game, and I'm curious to see how he looks moving forward. Like, was that just kind of an unexpected comeback that, you know, kind of rekindled his competitive spirit for one game in the second half? Or was the first half something of a foreshadowing of what's to come with Bradley Beal? Because if it is, you know, you can source any report you want. I mean, your eyes don't lie when you're looking at what a guy wants to do there. So I'm curious to see what happens moving forward. But him being a good soldier and him saying, I don't want to be traded, I'm not asking to be traded, look, I guess you can find anything in the bowels of the internet that might you might be able to find if you're on social media. But I haven't seen any of those critiques.
And listen, some of this at least is probably, like, even if he wanted to be traded, he doesn't want to be put in a position where it looks like he is the one forced, right? Like, some guys are just hyper-conscious of their image that way. Like, if the day comes where he's going to be traded, he'd rather not feel like he's the bad guy. Some guys don't mind it. Like, James Harden clearly did not mind being the bad guy at the end. He did sulk. He did drag his way through games. He did blow off training camp to go, you know, clubbing and whatever he was doing. Some guys are fine with doing it that way. I you know, obviously not everybody is. And I think maybe Bradley Beal's a little bit more self-conscious about how he's going to be perceived in Washington if and when he gets traded. And maybe he doesn't want it to be at his own hand, or maybe he wants it to be, you know, and look, maybe it's 100% absolute that he truly, truly does not want out. And he truly wants to ride this out. I just would question whether that's the most rational stance for him to have. This is not nitpicking him. This is not criticizing him. I'm just saying, if I were to put myself in his shoes, or to think about it through the prism of any other stars in the last 10 years, when your team plateaus, when you see a dead end and you're of that caliber, it's only natural and I think totally defensible to say, you know what, maybe I should go do this somewhere else where averaging 30, 35 points a game will actually net something other than the 10th place in the Eastern Conference. Like, it's totally fine if he wants that, but I think maybe he's just hyper-conscious of the idea that forcing his way out will somehow put him in a bad light. But
and look, there's a way, a mechanism for players to ask out without making themselves look as the bad guy. It's simply turning down an extension when you're going into the last year of the deal. This is why Anthony Davis kind of screwed it up when he was trying to force his way out of New Orleans by publicly asking for a trade mid-season. Like, he could have just waited till the end of the year and said no to the extension, forcing the Pelicans to do exactly what it was that they did. Bradley Beal could simply play out this season and say, look, I'm not going to sign the extension. I guess we'll see what happens at the end of next year, which the Wizards would not allow to happen. Like, if you're the Wizards, you simply can't allow an asset like Bradley Beal to go into the walk year of his contract without any guarantees he's going to be there long term. He becomes the guy you're going to trade. So there's a pathway for Bradley Beal to continue to look like the good guy in this situation and ultimately get exactly what he wants.
Yeah. And look, maybe there's some miracle in the offing here. Maybe the Wizards pull a rabbit out of a hat and there's some amazing trade they pull off. Maybe, Westbrook does find the fountain of youth. I mean, he looked like his old self the other night, but, you know, he's got to be able to do that game in, game out, and the two of them have to be at their peak together all the time. Maybe Rui Hachimura takes the leap and Denny Avdija develops really quick. Like, maybe. But I'm sorry, I don't see it. And I will never, until the Wizards prove otherwise, I believe that their best path forward and his best path forward is probably a trade. If you can get a sweetheart deal, if you can get the Paul George or Anthony Davis kind of deal with players and picks and set yourself up for the future and get Beal to a team where he's got a more developed roster around him and can contend, then that still seems to me like the best solution for everybody. I get it. It's not easy. It's not easy if you're Bradley Beal and you love where you're playing. It's not easy if you're the Wizards, who already just had to make the very difficult decision to trade John Wall a month ago, but 2 months ago, whenever that was. But I just think that as a practical matter, that's still where this ends up. And nobody will be wrong for doing it. Nobody should be criticized for doing it unless they make a bad trade. It's just the life cycle of a team sometimes. If you don't get where you need to go when you've got one of the best players in the league, then sometimes you got to try something else. And for him, I think he'd be better off. He might be happier elsewhere because if he loves playing there. But like, is he going to be more fulfilled competitively if he's on a top five, top 10 team in the league? Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's where we're headed, whether it's before the trade deadline or next summer. I would be surprised if this time next year Bradley Beal is a member of the Wizards. Howard, always good to talk to you, man. Appreciate it. We'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When we come back, my conversation with Jason Tatum. So in this month's SI, I wrote a profile of Jason Tatum, Boston's all-star forward, who ranks among the best young players in the NBA, a future MVP candidate even. He may be an MVP candidate this season. We spoke for about a half an hour recently. Here is an excerpt from that interview. Your mom is a big reason why you're here. She had you at a very young age and made raising you as a single mother her top priority. How old were you when you realized the sacrifices your mother was making?
I used to go to class with my mom all the time when she was in undergrad because, didn't have like a babysitter or anything. And she had me her freshman year of college, but she was 19. So even in graduate school, I remember going to class with her all the time and just sitting there being quiet. And but at the time, it was like, this is just all I knew. So it was normal. It wasn't like I knew that, we didn't have much. Or, when I had to go to the neighbor's house to ask to borrow food, it wasn't really until I got older. And then, as I started going to school, just talking to other kids and, seeing how kind of like, we live different lives. That I started to get a better understanding. But, at that time, if that's all you just think that's just how it goes.
Borrowing food from your neighbors, what do you remember about that?
I really didn't have a choice. And it was just the situation. So, it wasn't like I had an option, like, I'd rather be here than doing this. It was just like, no, that's just what we do. I was cool with it. Give me a snack, something to eat, and just sit there and be quiet.
How long has playing in the NBA been the dream?
Yeah, as early as I can remember, playing basketball, watching it, it was just something that was instinctual. That was like, this is just, it just felt right. This is what I wanted to be, what I wanted to do. And I remember I always went to private school, and I remember being in class, and everybody else in the class was like, they wanted to be like their parents. And their parents were like doctors and lawyers and veterinarians and real estate agents and stuff like that. And I remember I was like, I want to be in the NBA. And the teacher was like, she kind of giggled, and she was like, be more realistic. And everybody in the class kind of laughed. And that was, I don't know, that's just something I always remembered. I remember I was crying when I went home, and my mom was just like, as long as I believe in you and you believe in yourself, it don't really matter what other people think. And that was just something that always stuck with me, that like, I remember I was, even now, like, look at me now. And I remember, my teacher kind of laughed at the thought of what I wanted to do. But I don't know, I just always just knew, like, is this or nothing.
How'd that dream start?
It probably started with my dad. He played at St. Louis University and played overseas a couple of years. And, the time I spent with him, we were just always in the gym. I was just always around basketball. And, you know, whether if I would go to the gym and he was playing summer, you know, leagues, pro-ams in the summertime, you know, I'd be in the gym for like 6-7 hours and I would be on the side shooting and playing and watching. And that's just all I really wanted to do. I just always wanted to be in the gym, wanted to play basketball, wanted to be around it as early as I can remember.
You're known to watch a lot of film. That started when you were a kid, right?
I was real young, and you know, I remember vividly my dad telling me, he was like, when YouTube was out, he was like, I know you love watching, you know, your favorite players, and you know, don't look at the end result, don't look at, you know, just the ball going in, you know, look at, you know, their footwork and, you know, how they got open, how they came off a pin down, how they came off a screen, you know, look at, you know, all the things before the shot. And, you know, he kind of taught me that. And not just my favorite players, but other guys that around the league. And I just always remember, you know, he was like, don't look at, you know, when they score, look at how, you know, how they got their shot off, and, you know, try to apply that and just look at things differently, even from a young age.
What kind of film were you watching?
Kobe for sure. And, you know, obviously, you know, my dad put me on Michael Jordan, but I never really got to see him play live. He told me to watch Paul Pierce, Joe Johnson, Melo. And then I got older, I was watching KD and Paul George, guys like that.
Your dad was pretty tough on you when it came to basketball, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of a typical, you know, story or movie about, you know, a dad coaching his son and, you know, how that could be kind of like times that by 10. You know, my parents was 19 when they had me, and we joke about it all the time. I tell them, like, you know, y'all didn't have no patience when y'all had me. And, you know, at the time, it kind of like, I felt like it kind of hurt our relationship. But, you know, looking back, it was just his way of, you know, him trying to think, you know, getting the best out of me or push me. And ever since I was young, I always played 2 or 3 grades up. You know, if I was in third grade, I was playing sixth grade. If I was in sixth grade, I was practicing with his high school team, you know, 4 or 5 days a week. And anytime he thought I was playing soft or wasn't playing up to my potential, you know, he thought that, you know, if he kind of like embarrassed me or, you know, got on me in front of everybody, you know, that if I was upset, it would make me play better. And he did it often, and he didn't care who was around. You know, my mom, my grandma was a gym full of people. If I was 6 years old, if I was 12, you know, he just thought different methods, you know. And I mean, looking back on it, it worked, you know, because, you know, I was always trying to prove him wrong. But yeah, he was super tough on me when I was kind of, you know, speaking basketball.
Any good examples?
Oh man, it was so many different, you know. I remember him literally like grabbing me by my jersey. I mean, my dad's a big guy, like 6'6", 240. And at the time I was young, and I remember one time he like, it was during halftime, he grabbed me by my jersey and like literally picked me up by my shirt and like put me against the wall. Like I was over his head and, you know, cussing me out and screaming at me. And I was just crying. And I just remember like everybody was just watching like, damn, is this really happening? And I like, you know, I had tears coming down my eyes the whole second half. But then I would score like 25 straight. And you know, that was his way of like, oh, I keep doing that. You know, this is the way, if I push his buttons, he'll play better. But it was just stuff like that, like, you know, with phones and social media now, like, you know, no, that can't happen. But, you know, that was him. And, you know, that's just how he was.
Getting drafted by Boston, you weren't a Celtics fan, and they were not a typical lottery team. How did you feel about it?
At the time, I was just so thrilled that, you know, ever since I was 3, you know, 16 years later, my dream finally came true. That's a long time, you know, to work towards something. You know, you think about how many people at that age, you know, set a goal and it, you know, it comes true. I mean, that was an incredible feeling. And at the time, I was just, I was hoping anybody would pick me. I didn't care who called my name. So, you know, draft night was one of the best days, you know, ever. And it's hard to, you know, kind of compare that to something.
You've accomplished a lot in a short period of time. All-Star, All-NBA, you now have a long-term contract. What's next on your checklist?
You know, I think for me, the most important thing is just, I think about God. People remember the guys that win. Not to say the people that didn't win championships aren't, you know, great and things like that, but they really, really, you know, talk about and remember the guys that, you know, get to the top. And for me, that's the ultimate goal, is just I want to be remembered as, you know, a guy that wins and wins championships. And, you know, if you do that, everything else will take care of itself, you know, scoring titles and MVP and all defensive teams. So just being a guy that can, you know, be that guy on the team that can win a championship.
You've had a lot of playoff experience in a pretty short period of time. What do you take away from that?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you got to win 16 games to win a championship, and playing against the best teams. And, you know, I've been in the Eastern Conference Finals twice, and it's hard, you know, every possession and every game is so, the value is so important. And, you know, people don't understand it. And obviously people that will have won championships, you know, really know how tough it is. And even people like me that haven't, you know, I can only imagine, like, you know, how much it takes to get to that next level. And it's nothing that you should, like, undermine, you know, the importance and how tough it is to do that.
That second year, so many expectations, and that team didn't live up to them. What did you take away from that?
Really that, you know, you don't take for granted, you know, like the year before. Like, you know, when we went to the Eastern Conference Finals, you know, that was my first year, so I just thought that, you know, that shit was normal. And, you know, this is just how it's supposed to be. And then the next year I realized, you know, things can go south, things can, you know, be tougher, and, you know, things can just go wrong. And it made me really appreciate, you know, the year before, and just, you know, how valuable, you know, things, you know, things like that, that are. And I think that's the biggest thing I took away from it, you know, just to, you know, can't take anything for granted. May not always come be around like that, or, you know, how different each season can be. So, you know, just to really take advantage, you know, when opportunities like that come along.